Matt Bubala on 720 WGN. Good morning, everybody. We're live in the Allstate Showcase Studio in the Tribune Tower on the Magnificent Mile. I'm excited to welcome into the studio Natalie Shure. Natalie, you and I do not know each other at all, but I somehow started following you on Twitter. I can't remember how. Somebody must have retweeted something you tweeted, and you cracked me up, so I started following you, and then we got to know each other just a little bit through Twitter, and I saw that you were in town this weekend for the Democratic Socialists of America Convention.
Yes. Hello. Thank you. It's so good to meet you in person.
Thanks for coming in. So where is this taking place at?
It is being held at University of Illinois at Chicago.
Okay.
At their student center and their forum. And so I'm there for the rest of the weekend.
But you're actually a Chicagoan, right? Did you grow up in Chicago?
Yeah, I did. I grew up right outside of the city. My family lives here now. So I'm so happy to come back whenever I can. I'm here for weddings all the time, family stuff.
And your parents, all right, because let's just get this away. Socialism has a bad stigma. If you say, I'm a democratic socialist, it sounds like you're wearing camos and you're saying we're going to take over companies and all these things like that. I think especially here in the Midwest, I don't understand. I was reading on the website today trying to get a better understanding of, okay, what is this all about? So I'll make you explain that in a minute. When your parents tell their friends, my daughter's in town for the Democratic Socialists of America Convention, are they telling their friends that, or they know that their friends will be like, what? She's doing what? She's crazy.
I think that, you know, my parents' friends probably know that I'm a little headstrong and, you know, they know that. You know, I'm their daughter who's not married, who's moved around to all these cities. I think that they, you know, they like me, but they think I'm a little eccentric.
Well, they just tell friends, oh, she lives in Los Angeles.
Yeah, and she used to live in New York, and she lived in Russia before that, and that's
fine. Did you live in Russia?
I did.
Oh, well. Mm-hmm. Isn't that interesting?
Yeah.
How was Russia?
I mean, it's interesting. It's a fascinating place. It's way more nuanced than people realize.
Yeah, I imagine it is. Did you live in Moscow or did you live somewhere?
St. Petersburg.
Okay.
I studied abroad there. Then I did a fellowship in Siberia, lived in Ukraine between those two things.
How was Siberia?
Very cold. I was there in the winter.
So it's true what they say.
Yeah, you need gloves. I would recommend that.
At all times.
Yeah.
Even indoors.
Yeah, I got off the plane without gloves, and it feels like needles in your hands.
I'm not used to this type of cold.
Yeah.
And you grew up in Chicago.
And I grew up in Chicago. It registers as pain, not even cold. It registers as you're being stabbed. It's the worst.
Okay. All right. So we had a lot to talk about. Let's start with socialism and the Democratic Socialists of America. Mm-hmm. What in the world is that?
So you are completely correct that socialism has a really bad stigma.
Sure.
And I think part of that is that Americans have to realize that they grew up as targets of propaganda. That if you are of a certain age and you've lived in America your whole life, that you were the target of a very concerted propaganda effort for decades and decades.
Against communist Russia.
Exactly.
Right, basically?
That there was a concerted effort to make sure that you don't like socialism, to make sure that you think that the idea is absolutely anathema to anything that's positive.
Okay.
To make sure that you think it's hateful and insidious. And a lot of people have those ideas. And I'm not saying that they're not allowed to have those ideas, but I do think that people need to realize that those are ideas that they've internalized mm-hmm. as a result of very consciously constructed campaigns.
Now, let me ask, when that campaign was going on, while that gave socialism a bad name, do you believe it was wrong at the time? I mean, was Russia's form of socialism a good thing that we went against that we shouldn't have?
No. I mean, first of all, I think that to judge countries as good or bad overall is a very simplistic way of looking at things. I don't think that I have to make a case for socialism always historically and politically having been good, which it hasn't been.
Because let's face it, Catholicism hasn't always been good. There's a lot of things that we hold near and dear to our hearts, not always so good.
Yeah, capitalism has some problems too,
sure.
Obviously. But in most parts of the world, socialism is considered a valid viewpoint. In the vast majority of European countries, there is a socialist party among several other parties. And not everyone's a socialist, but it's not considered this completely dirty, objectionable, shocking thing to
right.
be. It's not something that people have to keep to themselves or hide. It's not, it doesn't have the same ring to it that it does here. And a lot of that is because of the context that we grew up in.
Russia and Cuba and socialism bad. And
exactly. That was a specific function of our foreign policy.
Yeah.
The fact that people feel that way about socialism and communism here has a lot to do with our specifically American cultural situation.
Okay. So tell me what is good about socialism. Tell me why socialism is an important, way to think about things or maybe should be woven more into our fabric.
Sure. So basically, the difference between communism, I'm sorry, the difference between socialism and capitalism is who controls the economy and for whose benefit.
Okay.
And so in capitalism, you basically have a select few people. You have capitalists who provide capital, which is money and resources required to run the economy. So if someone wants to run a business, you can't start a business with literally nothing. You know, people talk about bootstrapping, but to start a business, what do you need? You need resources. You need employees. You need something that people want to buy. All of those things take resources to start up with, and those are forms of capital that you have to invest something into your business. You mm-hmm. have to hire employees who are then beholden to things that you need. And if you are going to work, if I'm going to work, I have to behave in a certain way. If I want to get my wages, I have to do what my boss wants me to do. I have to clock in, I have to clock out. And that then at the end of the day, we make profit. That's what our business does. And that profit goes up to the boss, ultimately, the capitalist who put the money in the first place, right?
Okay.
And so in socialism, those relationships are changed. Socialism, the idea of it is that you can structure a business or structure an institution in such a way that everyone collectively provides the capital that it takes to run this thing, and that everyone then distributes it so that at the end the profit doesn't go to someone at the top who didn't actually do any of the work to produce these things. The profits are shared among the people who created the value.
Okay. That could be done now by anybody if they wanted to, right? There's nothing in our economy that holds us back from setting up a business like that, right?
Well, I mean, the entire economic structure holds us back from doing that. That's just a very, you know, theoretical, specific explanation of how it works in a business. A broader way of thinking about socialism versus capitalism is that in socialism, we really pay close attention to the fact that we want everyone in a society to have certain things, that, you know, we believe that everyone has a right to housing, to healthcare, to childcare, to elder care, mm-hmm. that there is a set of things that every human wants, that every human needs, and that we decide to decommodify those things. You don't have to pay for those things. You don't have to buy them on the market. They're provided for everybody.
Mm-hmm.
And so we don't have a situation, we don't live in a society that assumes those things. We live in a society that commodifies those things, that you have to buy those things. And so what's stopping a business from being set up in a socialist way, in the way that I described, is that there's no way that it can thrive. There's no incentive for setting up a situation like that, that there's no reward, that would be basically just a form of pure philanthropy. And I'm not saying that that doesn't exist at all.
Well, would that be, though? I mean, if you and a group of friends decided we're going to start a business, we're all going to pitch our money in. Okay, mm-hmm. So we're going to be the capital, and then we're going to share the profits in the end. If you do really well and your company makes more money, you're all still making more money. It doesn't stop you from still, it doesn't become pure philanthropy because you still, as long as you know, your business is a success, it doesn't stop it from making more profits or...
Sure. Well, in that situation, if you're trying to basically beat your competitors in a capitalist situation with the socialist business, you are still beholden to the exact same rules that capitalism plays by. And there have been, you know, I mean, honestly, like, we're talking about a specifically socialist construction, but there have been businesses... How about Whole Foods recently? Okay. Whole Foods was recently bought by Walmart, and mm-hmm. now people are really curious about what's going to happen with that business. But Whole Foods' whole thing before this was basically that it was going to be conscious capitalism as a business, that it was going to treat its workers really well, that it was going to be this really, evolved, fascinating business that was going to be different than the rest of capitalism. And so,
and that was a big part of their success, right?
Well, that was a big part of its ethos. But, you know, they're still in the same construction that we are. They're still in the same, you know, system. And so they still have to compete with other businesses who don't do that. They're still at a race to the bottom. If I'm competing, if my business is a capitalist business and it's competing against your business, then I still want to create the greatest possible profits for my shareholders, which means I have to keep costs down. I have to make more money. And of course, that means that I'm going to squeeze my workers more. Right? Like, if I want to make the most possible money and spend the least possible amount of money doing sure. that, where am I going to cut those costs? I'm going to look at my, you know, expense report and realize, like, I'm spending a lot of money on labor. I'm paying a ton of money to my employees to do this. And here's one way to cut a line off of that. I'm going to pay them less than what I pay now.
But if you set up your company as a socialist company, and so you're, I mean, these companies that are squeezing the profits and squeezing everything there because they owe to shareholders or because for whatever reason they want to do that, they don't have to do that. I mean, let's face it, let's look at Apple is the world's largest company. They have $250 billion. They could, if they wanted to, just start doling that out or doing things like that, but they don't. I mean, I just feel like you still have some control over your profits if you set it up as a socialist company, even though you have to compete. Now, if you have to do this because, well, costs are too high, we're not profitable because these guys are cutting costs and they're, you know, gouging their workers and doing these things, then I can mm-hmm. see it. But as far as the profit side, that's really up to the people who are running the company, right? I mean, it, in a socialist setting where you're not answering to shareholders, you're not answering to some bank that holds your notes or anything like that. If you and your five friends set it up, you put your money in the end, if you hold to the ethos of we're going to keep running the company this way, mm-hmm. you could do that, right? Or do you feel like in this society, the pressure, Whole Foods caves, they sell out to Walmart, that always happens in the end if it's set up the way it's set up now?
Yeah, I mean, I don't think that there are too many options to have a sustainably ethical scenario under capitalism in the way that you're describing, just because, yeah, it's a system that's based on competition. And, you know, Whole Foods, its entire brand was based on being supremely ethical, was based on being really kind to its workers in a way that, you know, let's also remind ourselves that, you know, I think it paid about $14 an hour on average, and that's not a living wage. But even if so, they're still competing with other businesses in the system. I mean, if you are trying to be a socialist company and you're not making profits, then you're not going to be rewarded by this system. People aren't going to invest in your business. People aren't going to shop at your business in the same way, and you're going to suffer.
Well, do you think that's true, though? People are not going to shop at your business in the same way. I think a lot of Whole Foods success mm-hmm. was based on the way this was set up, that this whole Walmart thing could hurt them because you felt good about shopping at Whole Foods. You felt like they're, you know, they're better to their employees, they're better, it's better food. It's you know, there's a stigma with Walmart, and Whole Foods was exactly the opposite of that.
Well, I mean, that's an argument that's brought up a lot, but I just don't think that that's that powerful, because that really relies on a very individual ethos. That's basically asking every single customer that you have, the millions and millions of people who shop at your store every day, that's asking each of them to be individually better than all of the market forces they've been raised to respect. That's asking each of those people to, hey, don't look for the cheapest price. Don't look for, you know, the market forces that you understand to be the ones that you should reward. Just, you know, sit and do your homework, learn to be better, be a nice, kind, ethical person, and decide to shop at this place above another because you're a better person. Asking people to do things like that on an individual level is completely unreasonable.
Okay, but marketing is incredibly powerful, and we spend more than we would otherwise all the time because of marketing, or because of what we perceive as we're better than. Mm-hmm. People don't shop. There's millions and millions and millions of people that shop at Walmart. There's a lot of people who won't shop at Walmart who will go spend more at Target because I don't shop at Walmart. Mm-hmm. You know, so there is that too. And I think that places like Whole Foods, Chipotle play on the we're better than everybody else. And sure. that is a market niche too, isn't it? Like for a car company or for Apple, you know, why do so many people buy Apple products that are so marked up and so expensive? Maybe they're better than the Android stuff, but I think there's also just a cachet to that. And I think there is a market for that, clearly, for some companies, right?
Yeah, I mean, there's absolutely a cachet. And I think that cachet, as you're describing it, is pretty different than, you know, shopping ethically. I think that those are two completely different market segments and they're two different market motivations. I think that someone who's looking for cachet is not that they're necessarily distinct. Someone who's shopping for cachet might also be shopping for, you know, ethical validation, but those aren't, like, that's not the same act. And so I think that someone who is shopping for market validation, those people do exist, but that's also something that, you know, shopping for, like, spending more money to convince yourself that you're a better person, which I think is, like, part of, let's be honest, part of Whole Foods business model.
Yeah.
Is, you know, not all of us can afford to do that. There
sure.
there are fewer people that can afford to do that or that want to do that with their money than people who will just go to Walmart or Target or the cheapest option. As far as shopping for cachet, then you're talking about, you know, making a specific product,
yeah.
making it attractive to your shoppers, which again, I think is a very capitalist goal and that will eventually lead to a race to the bottom, which will squeeze your workers, squeeze your labor, and lead to a lot of the same problems that I was describing.
Okay, so we're going to take a quick break. And when we come back, the question is, so does the entire system have to change to socialism for this to work? It sounds like you're telling me part-time socialism can't work. We need a complete revolution and rebooting of everything to move over. So we'll ask you that after we do this. 312-981-7200. Matt Bubala with Natalie Scherr talking about the Democratic Socialists of America on 720 WGN. Matt Bubala here with you, 720 WGN. A couple minutes before 3, we'll do the news here with Roger and then more with Natalie Scherr, who is here. Adam Ruins Everything is on True TV, right?
Uh-huh.
So we've also got to talk about how you got involved in all that and your interesting career. But we're talking about the Democratic Socialists of America. And thank you all for texting. Natalie misspoke and said it was Walmart, but it was actually Amazon who bought.
Yeah, you know, ModCloth is an apparel company that was just bought by Walmart, and
okay.
I mixed the two up. Sorry.
No, it's okay.
I wouldn't. I mean,
doesn't change
else,
anything you were saying.
Still, no, it's you
eventually
know.
You're saying anybody that tries to do things in a socialist sort of way or set up, we're going to be this, we're going to be that, we're going to be this, we're going to be that. Still in the same system. Eventually, you're going to sort of cave to the same pressures.
Yeah, market forces are set up that they're going to be eaten out or chewed up by the bigger company, by the bigger capitalists.
If they choose to be, though, right? I mean, they didn't have to sell. If you're a successful company, you don't have to sell. But somebody throws $13 billion at you, you're probably really tempted to sell.
Yeah, I mean, basically, the forces are set up that if you don't sell, if you don't decide to defer to these market forces, if you decide to be super plucky and, you know, steal yourself through all of these things and be the interesting tiny socialist company forever, that's a very, very, very difficult choice to make. And literally every market force is set up to push against that.
Okay, so you either have to get bigger or get sold is what you're saying, right? Because like
yeah.
Mark Zuckerberg was offered $1 billion way back in the day and he didn't sell. And now he's bigger than Google probably, right? Google offered him $1 billion probably 10 years ago for Facebook. And it was a big deal at the time that he didn't sell out because here was $1 billion.
Mm-hmm.
And now they didn't stay some small company. But I mean, so you have your choices.
Sure.
But you're saying trying to stay small like that and just say, this is what we are and we're going to, you know, be this company like this.
Mark Zuckerberg didn't not sell to Google because he was trying to protect his employees and make sure. I mean, these are completely different things.
I'm just saying not everybody has to sell out. They could, but I imagine what you would say is, yeah, but he wouldn't have stayed the small little mom and pop. Somebody would have came and eaten up Facebook had they not grown to become the behemoth they were, right? He would have been MySpace had he stayed this little, the Facebook, more or less, right?
Sure. Yeah. I mean, MySpace disappeared.
They did, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, they did. And Zuckerberg didn't. Okay. So maybe that's not here or there. 312-981-7200 is the number. So I was trying to read up a little bit. So What? So I said the question would be, you're saying that companies like that can't survive in the system we have set up. So does everything have to be blown up? Do we have to go to a completely socialist way of thinking in this country for the DSA people to be happy with things? Or is there, does socialism work elsewhere? Where's a famous example of socialism working right now?
Sure. So, I mean, I would argue, first of all, disclaimer, I can't speak for the entire organization.
Of course not.
Right?
Of course not.
I'm just here. It's very late at night.
That's no excuse. You're firing on all cylinders. You're fine.
I don't know the difference between Walmart and Amazon. you know, I'm just...
You misspoke. It wasn't a big deal.
But basically, I would argue there aren't too many examples in world history of pure capitalism or of pure socialism.
Okay.
That there are a number of systems that, including ours currently, that have a sort of hybrid system in place. Right now, we do have capitalism, obviously.
Mm-hmm.
We have a lot of... checks on capitalism built into our system as well. We do have a shrinking safety net if the rising right has anything to do with it. We have...
Well, so what is the socialism currently in America? It would be Social Security?
Yeah, we have programs like Social Security. We
Medicare,
have Medicare.
Medicaid.
Well, knock on wood, we've got Medicaid
so far,
right now.
So far.
We've got, a fledgling labor movement that's, mm-hmm. Bargained for
certain
rights.
The Fight for 15,
rights.
That's things
not,
like that.
Those aren't actually public programs, but
right.
those are examples of ways that people have incorporated socialist thought and socialist theory into our system.
Regulations that we have, like EPA regulations, banking regulations, things like that. Any mm-hmm. limits we put on market forces.
Exactly.
Governmentally,
yeah, yeah.
Are a form of socialism.
I don't want to say that they're a form of socialism, but we don't have unmitigated capitalism.
Okay.
In other countries, things like Denmark, things like the Nordic countries, Denmark, Sweden, Finland, we have what a lot of people would consider a fairly comprehensive social democratic safety net. They have free education, they have free retirement care, free child care, free health care. They have all of these programs that basically socialize basic needs that you aren't on the hook for providing your every need in life, that we've decided that we're in a society that we collectivize certain things that we all need and want, and that beyond that we're on our own. So it's a combination of systems that we're aware of that try to achieve things.
And there have been pushes here in America for certain things, those most notably mm-hmm. healthcare. Single
yeah.
payer is a thing that you tweet about quite a bit and talk about quite
mm-hmm.
a bit. We've got to take a break for the news, but then let's talk about that after the news. It's 3:00 in the morning. This is Chicago's very own 720 WGN Chicago and WGNRadio.com. If you're an Amazon Echo user, just say play WGN Radio. Here's the news with Roger Badish. Mr. Badish, Matt Bobala with you on 720 WGN. Sitting alongside me is Natalie Schur. She is it a researcher on Adam Ruins Everything?
A story producer.
A story producer.
Mm-hmm.
Started out as a researcher, working
yes.
way up.
Yes, I still do the research.
Still do the research. Adam Ruins Everything is on True TV, right?
Mm-hmm.
New season coming up. We're in a season right now. Where are we at?
We're in the throes of season two, yes.
And does that mean that you are now on hiatus? Is it all produced, or are you still working as are you just weekend off and you're right back to work?
Yeah,
or?
I was on hiatus, and now I am working more. We got some more episodes on season two, so I'm working on those.
Excellent. Good.
Mm-hmm.
Good. And good for you. We'll talk about your... So you went to college, you went to DePaul,
mm-hmm.
then you went in the Peace Corps
yes.
to Russia.
To Ukraine.
To the Ukraine, sorry. Well...
It's okay.
Soon to be Russia.
Mm-hmm.
And that's got you mostly interested in socialism, is learning more over there about how socialism worked and the misperceptions maybe we had about it all along?
Yeah, I was really interested in Soviet history in college, and I studied Russian, which I think is why I was placed in that part of the world for the Peace Corps. And I think that obviously the Soviet Union had so many problems that I wouldn't make excuses for, and I wouldn't try to say, no, this was good, this problem didn't exist. And I don't think too many socialists would try to make that argument. I do think it's illuminating to realize that growing up in the United States, you hear things about the Soviet Union that aren't necessarily fair or accurate.
So like what? Give me an example of what we would think that you would say, you know, I saw it and that's not how it was.
Sure. I mean, I think that you just learn that people were miserable all the time.
Yes.
And
we do think that,
that life was horrible. And obviously there were aspects of life and history that were like that. But there were also people that lived and thrived during that time. You meet living people who lived during that time and they have stories of joy and they have stories of being with family and friends the way that we were. And so you kind of realize that
we had a picture for a lot of people that just didn't really exist over there.
Well, and there are, like, there is serious misery that did exist there. I don't want to say that that
Well, just
didn't.
Like serious misery exists here in the United States every single day,
exactly.
right?
Exactly. That's kind of what you start to realize, that, you know, you see every swath of misery in another country's context, and then you say, oh, see, like, that breadline, that's why socialism doesn't work. That's why you can never do that. And then you'll walk or drive right past several tents of homeless people in the middle of Chicago, in the middle of Manhattan, one of the wealthiest parts of the entire country, and you won't even bat an eye.
Yeah.
Or you'll think like, oh, that's too bad that that happens, and you won't connect it, and you would never say, oh, that's why capitalism doesn't work.
Yeah. No, that's true. We wouldn't. I'll give you that. So let's talk about single payer and healthcare, mm-hmm. because healthcare
sure.
has been a huge thing here in the United States, let's face it, since for the last 10 years, and certainly right now with President Trump and what he's trying to do with repeal and replace and all that stuff. And you are a big advocate for single payer.
Absolutely.
So explain to me the difference between single payer and what we have now. How would single payer work?
Sure. So very briefly, the Affordable Care Act is, a law that attempted to regulate the private insurance system that we have in America. We have a private insurance system as well as a few public systems. Obviously, for people ages 65 and over, we have Medicare. For people who are poor or disabled, we have Medicaid. We have the VA for people who are veterans. But for the most part, the vast majority of us have private insurance, which is mostly through our employers. Which I think that people will be very familiar with, that you have a plan that you pay a premium for, and you have a network, you have providers that, you know, you might be able to go to this doctor at this place, you might
sure.
be able to go to this hospital, you can't just go indiscriminately, you have to be very careful, and you pay a certain amount of money to get, you know, certain care within that context, and that's how you're able to
sure.
get healthcare.
Right.
And so that system is basically what we
have right now.
Yeah, and that we've entrenched through the ACA.
Right. So what would single payer be?
Single payer looks different in a few different countries, but generally it means single payer is one insurance pool. As opposed to right now, we have multi-payer, which means the people paying providers or the institutions paying providers are varied. It could be Medicare, it could be the VA, it could be Aetna, it could be Cigna. That if a hospital is trying to figure out who's going to pay the bill, they've got just dozens and dozens of choices. That's multi-payer.
Mm-hmm.
Single payer is one.
Including us is one of them, right? Does that include us in the multi-payer?
Absolutely,
because we
yeah.
also generally are paying.
Exactly.
A lot
yeah.
out of
if you
as
are
well.
An uninsured person,
even
if
with
you
insurance.
Got, well, yes. So if you, but if you have insurance, they would send that bill to, say, Cigna, and then Cigna would tap you on the shoulder and say, "Hey, buddy,
yeah, here's
we're
going
to need that last 30%." And so that is absolutely true. I think something around 70% of medical debt in the United States is held by people who are insured. People don't realize that.
Yeah, I believe it.
Yeah, there's absolutely, I mean, there are so many ways to have huge bills if you are insured. But, you know, knock on wood, if you are insured, they're sending the bill to one of dozens and dozens and dozens of different payers. In
yeah.
a single payer system, that's one unified pool that everyone pays into that no one's out of.
So that's run by the government then. So how would it work here in the U.S., say, just on our taxes each year, or there'd be something we pay that everybody is required to somehow pay into? How does that work?
Sure. So, and like I said, that would differ depending on what model we decided to adapt.
It's the Natalie Scherr model. Natalie is in charge of health care. All right, Natalie. Donald Trump calls up, says, Natalie, it's just not working out. These Republicans won't vote on what I want, so go ahead. Knock it out.
Sure. I mean, what in this very likely scenario.
I think that, let's face it, Natalie.
Yeah, I mean, he's probably texting me during the show. I'm not going to check my phone.
Would you be that stunned with what we've seen in the last 6 months if he just, I would be like, yeah, I could see that.
Yeah, I mean, okay, so if it did come to that, I would feel very on the spot. And so what I would do is I would log on to my computer and go to the website of the Physicians for a National Health Program, PNHP.
Okay.
Because they've developed a model. They've developed a proposal for single payer in the United States, which most closely resembles Canada, which is a public insurance pool with private providers. And so that's distinct from the UK, which is completely public providers. So their physicians are, for the most part, public employees. Canada's a little different. I think Canada would be a little less scary for Americans who are used to private providers.
Yeah. Private providers being the doctors. So the doctors would still be in private practice, would still be working for the hospitals, things like that.
Yeah, I mean, the doctors and the nurses and the physical therapists and anyone that you go to for your health care, that they wouldn't be public employees. They wouldn't be absorbed by a public system. They'd still be private providers, but we'd have one unified public insurance system that everyone would be folded into.
And how do we pay into that?
Well, we pay into it through taxes generally, and so that scares people, but I would caution them to, I would remind those people, like, how much do you pay in premiums? How much do you pay in deductibles and co-pays? We all spend so much money on healthcare.
Oh, yeah.
Staggering amounts. In almost every single payer system, people actually save money.
Okay, so you say through taxes. So on our taxes at the end of the year, out of each paycheck, a sales tax, how in general, or in the Natalie Scherr system, are we collecting these taxes?
Well, and so that's, you know, that's something that differs country by country, too. In the UK, I believe their, you know, value added tax is around 10%. So that's mostly, you know, sales tax every time there's a market transaction, things that you don't necessarily see if, you know, a lumber company sells something to I don't know, like a desk company. I doubt there's actually a desk company, but that, like, there are a lot of...
There might be.
Sure. There are a lot of business transactions that you don't necessarily see that each of those things are taxed. And so at the end of the day, when you pay for something, the price is higher because of all those taxes that every...
So we'd pay an extra 10% theoretically on just about everything we do.
Sure, 10% or more.
That sounds scary, Natalie.
Well, it sounds scary, but you also aren't paying premium. I don't know what you pay on your healthcare premiums.
I pay an insane amount of my premiums.
I pay such an insane amount, and my deductible is about $6,000 before I even get any benefits, which means, like, I'm not going to the doctor unless it's a freaking emergency.
Yeah.
Like, if I'm coughing up a spleen, yeah, I guess I'll go. If my stomach hurts, I'm going to wait it out.
Yeah, so I have four children, and so we have, when I left the Tribune Company where I worked here and started my own business, I tried to buy the exact healthcare we had here. And 10 years ago, that, when our kids were younger and we were all younger, that was about $1,000 a month.
Sure.
And as of last year, that exact plan was up to about $2,800 a month.
Gosh.
And so we changed it. And that was with like a $500 deductible. It was reasonable that you would actually go and get your health care.
Mm-hmm.
And so now we changed it to go back to paying about $1,200 a month or $1,300 a month with like a $3,500 deductible. And insane. So now we're in the same boat. Like, okay, well, if something goes wrong, then we're doing every elective, whatever. Your shoulder's out. Now's the time. You know, once we meet that deductible, we're going to go to town and try to get every single thing done.
Wait till December 1st. Yeah.
Try to get every single thing done. So, yeah, it's a tough system right now.
It's very tough.
So we all pay in through a tax, and that would gather enough money to cover everybody in America? Because the way it works right now is... there's still how many people uninsured in America?
About 26 million.
26 million. So you're saying, let's add these 26 million people in. You're already paying an insane amount right now to keep this going. We're going to add in 26 million more people. Is a 10% tax on just about every transaction going to cover that?
Well, okay. First of all, I don't know what the exact 10% tax on every transit, and we might not do it that way. We might do it through an income tax.
It's your way. You've got to decide right now.
Okay.
Trump is calling.
But so what I would like to point out is that there are a lot of ways that people think single payer will be so expensive, but there are actually a lot of ways that it saves money compared to the system we have now. And that's a few really important things. One, okay, people don't realize the admin costs in our current system are absolutely staggering. Right now, think about it. Every single provider, so that's every single hospital, every single doctor's office in the United States, they have to hire a whole admin team to figure out, okay, you know, Matt came in, his kids got, you know, right, this shot, that shot, someone got this. Now they have to prepare the bill. They have to send it to your insurer. They have to, you know, figure out what their deal is with Cigna. And then maybe their next patient had Aetna. Their next patient after that was on Medicare.
So they've got a whole staff and everything just figuring out the 18
exactly
different ways they've got
so
to try to build this.
It's so complicated. And it's not as if there's a set rate for each provider and each insurance
company. They have
a
separate agreement with everybody on what they pay for whatever.
Yeah, they're negotiating based on what it was, based on whether your plan's silver or bronze. So it's incredibly tedious. There are, you know, people appeal their decisions all the time.
Yeah.
That they're, you know, these insurance companies, and so the insurance companies too hire all of these administrators because they are incentivized to basically deny your claims. That's how they make money. They make money by taking in more in premiums than they pay out in healthcare claims.
Sure.
So then Aetna receives this healthcare claim, this bill from your family, and they look at it and say, oh my gosh, you misspelled your last name. Or not even that petty. It could be something as simple as, you know, you are not in network. This is not the network as we've defined it for
right
the bronze plan that you've
right
purchased because we changed it last month. You might not have known about it, but haha, now we only have to pay this much. And so then they dwindle that down, and then maybe your family will repeal that or maybe they won't. But the fact is that, you know, this administrative cost is a huge part of the healthcare system on both sides, and it's incredibly inefficient. Single payer doesn't have that.
Single payer would cut out all of those insurance companies.
Exactly. Single payer, there's not someone sitting at a desk whose job it is to figure out how to deny as many claims as they can. Someone's not trying to figure out the rate that you pay out Cigna versus...
In fairness, do we know that they're there trying to figure out how to absolutely not pay for things? Or are they there? Because I'm going to be fair to the insurance companies right now, because
okay
they're a business too.
Okay.
And we sign an agreement. We agree to this. And yeah, believe me, I'm paying way too much and it's killing me. But let's just be fair to them and say maybe they're going through and they're not like cops writing speeding tickets at the end of the month to make their nut that they got to make sure to get rid of as much as they can.
Okay,
if they catch somebody, if you went to out of network, yeah, you're screwed. You screwed up. They're not going to pay for that because they have their agreements with certain doctors and whatever, right?
Sure. Okay. But, you know, if you want to be fair to insurance companies, I would love for someone to point out to me the value that they add over single payer. What exactly is...
I'm not saying they add value. I'm not saying they add value
okay
or that single payer
sure
is not a better way. I'm not at all. I'm just saying
okay
you're saying that they're there, you know like Scrooge, like counting pieces of coal, and we don't know that that's necessarily how it
okay
is.
Okay, sure. On an
it's the feeling we have.
Well, and that kind of goes back to what we were saying about capitalism. I don't think that each person working in the system individually is a monster, but that's what they're there to do. That's the function that they're providing, is that they are there to create profit on covering medical bills, and medical bills are extremely expensive. So it's not just the insurance companies. It's the fact that in a commodified system, every step of the healthcare system is designed to extract more money.
And that's the problem you have with healthcare in general, is healthcare should be a basic human right, and we shouldn't have companies trying to profit from the idea of healthcare. And that's what the problem is, right? That there are companies set up, insurance companies are set up to what? Make a profit. How do they make a profit? By either getting more money or paying
mm-hmm
out less for these fees. So that's an inherent issue that the socialists would say, here's an issue right here.
Sure.
We have companies trying to make a profit on people's health care. That's a bad idea.
Sure. And,
right?
And that's absolutely true. And the insurance companies aren't the only ones who do it. You know, every aspect. Hospitals. There are so many. If you ever look at a healthcare bill, there's an itemized bill where, you know, every single thing
that
you get
seem
charged
outrageous. Aspens
yeah
for like $200 and things
exactly
like that.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Absolutely. That every single part of that bill is basically designed to optimize exactly how much money that they can suck out of you, because they know that you're not going to complain too much, that it's not necessarily coming from you if you're insured, because they're going to be able to suck it out of Cigna.
Right.
And that Cigna's too small to complain. And that's the other reason that single payer is able to save money, is because single payer, if there's one public unified system, that system has the strength, that has the muscle to negotiate with providers.
Now, the concern becomes that this then leads to a poor quality of health care, that there's doctors aren't going to make as much money. There's not a profit system. Doctors want to make money. They went to school for a long time. They're paying off ridiculous debt to schools, which I know you'll get to, because we're going to take care of that for them. But there's all sorts of issues that go along with this. I don't know if you retweeted it or if I saw it from somebody else. There's been a little piece of video going around on social media that is, I forget who the guy is on MSNBC, but I think he's Canadian, and he's talking to some Republican lawmaker about the Republican lawmakers, like, all these Canadians are coming down here for their blah, 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 blah. And he's saying, listen, I grew up in Canada. None of that happens. Now, I will say, I was on vacation this winter in Mexico, and while we're talking about Trump, and this one guy was a guy from Calgary and a guy from near Edmonton, because we were watching they were arguing about the Flames and the Oilers. And the one guy was saying that, because I was talking about Trump and how unhappy I was at the time, and he was saying that the health care, we're talking about the healthcare thing, and he said, you know, the healthcare, he kind of made that argument that his mom, or he said, anybody with money in Canada, if it's something serious, they come to the States. That was his assumption or assertion. And he said that his own mom, he felt, was misdiagnosed with a cancer thing, and he wished she had gone to the States, things like that. So while that might not be the real reality, there are some people from Canada who actually say that. So there's probably a little bit of that anywhere. I guess the question is that really a huge issue? Are people en masse coming to Canada? I know the argument I saw from this commentator from Canada was, no, that does not happen. Of course, there's people near the border who maybe go over the border, but he argued that a much bigger deal is Americans buying their prescription drugs from Canada because they can get them more cheaply.
Yeah, there's literally no empirical evidence that suggests that Canadians coming to America for healthcare is happening in any significant numbers. That isn't to say that it's never, ever happened. But, you know, the instances in which it might have happened would have to involve... Do not outweigh and are incredibly rare. I mean, the fact is that if you look at any statistic on American healthcare versus Canadian healthcare, they're living longer, they're spending less money, they have more access to healthcare than we do. Every study would show that.
You know, it's interesting because to me, that doesn't necessarily mean that that's a better system. You say they live longer. Well, maybe they're healthier for a myriad of other reasons besides their health care. Let's face it, here in the U.S., with the way we eat, the way we do a lot of things culturally, we are not a very healthy group. Don't you think? I mean, overall, we're
yeah, I mean, I would agree. I would argue that has economic dimensions, but sure.
Well, I'm sure you can, but the fact is we eat bigger meals than ever. We don't, the way we work, just a lot of, and sure, that I agree, probably could paint a lot of that on the capitalist structure, but I think there's a lot more than just the single-payer system that keeps them maybe living longer, spending less on their healthcare, different things like that.
Well, certainly, I mean, spending less on healthcare is absolutely attributable to a single payer system for a number of reasons. We also have, I mean, tens of thousands of people who die each year of a lack of access to healthcare.
Sure.
You can actually,
and that does not happen, you would say, in any single payer country.
It absolutely doesn't happen in Canada, because in Canada, if you need healthcare, you can get it. One thing that people don't realize about, you know, the lines when people complain about the waits, if you are in dire need, you get to go to the front of the line, that it is tiered.
Is that different here in the U.S., though? If you are in dire need and you go into the hospital,
If you go into the emergency room, it's now a law, because we've had to enact laws to force hospitals to take people who show up at the emergency room. But the fact is, many, many, many serious health problems present themselves earlier than... I mean, you and I both know that there are a lot of things that you can die of that show up a lot earlier than when you go to the emergency room.
Sure.
That you're supposed to get care. You're supposed to have access to care well earlier than that.
So if I let's go before Obamacare or post replace and repeal, say 6 months from now, they finally somehow get this done. and you have no insurance and you go to the doctor, or you went right now with no insurance, they would still see you, would they not? I mean, would we do we really in America turn people away for health care, or are we scared to go because of the bills that we will be sent, things like that?
Well, both of those things happen, but absolutely in America we turn people away for not having. I mean, you go into the doctor before you sign in, they ask for proof of insurance.
Right.
That absolutely happens at a ton of providers. There are providers, you know, clinics.
Well, everybody asks for proof of insurance. They want to know who they're billing and what.
But, sure.
But I don't, because I have it, I don't know what happens if I say, yeah, I'm not insured right now. If they say, then give me a credit card, because is that what they do?
Absolutely, they
say,
do that.
We're going to charge you ahead of time.
Providers. There are some providers that specialize in, you know, that consider themselves more socially just, that don't necessarily do that and just bill you later.
Well, I imagine that also depends on where you're at, right?
That depends
on
where
you're at.
On
the North Shore, they're going
to
trust that you are going to pay. And down here on the South Side, they're going to ask for money ahead of time, because it's going to be dependent on who's coming in and how much money they think they have and the likelihood of them paying, I would think, too, right?
Well, in some cases, or it depends on, you know, there are certain providers with a mission that includes social justice that they won't necessarily ask for that. Sometimes places that offer those services are difficult to access. They don't exist everywhere. They're
sure.
not the norm. But yeah, the idea that doctors will treat you no matter where you are is absolutely false. And even if that were true, it's still very, I mean, anyone who's been treated that doesn't have the money to pay, if you are then bankrupt because of treatment you need, that's
yeah.
not exactly
yeah.
A reassuring situation.
Right. 312-981-7200. Quick break in the news. Can you hang out a little longer? It's
sure.
the middle of the night. You got nowhere to go,
yeah.
right? Okay. All right. Natalie Scheer is with us. I know she is driving a lot of you crazy. I might let a couple of you talk to her in a minute if we're
good
all
morning,
kind
everybody.
And nice. And
very rude.
And have a good social discussion about this. 312-981-7200. News next on 720 WGN. Matt Bubala with you, 720 WGN. Natalie Scheer is in studio with us for the Democrats Socialists of America Convention. That's the DSA. What is the website? If people want to find out, if people are willing to give this a chance and learn what you guys are all about, what is the website again?
DSA.org.
DSA.org. I was reading a little bit of it today because I was very scared of the whole idea of socialism. I'm not as scared of it. But it's still, you know, you're right. We have such an idea that we grew up with because mm-hmm. of Soviet socialism and things like that, and Cuba and what it is and how we must fight against it, these godless communists. And what's the difference between communism and socialism?
I mean, very, very boilerplate. Planning an economy for people versus just leaving it to its own devices for profit.
Okay. So in communism, or the way the Soviet Union was set up, because I think you talk about with socialism that the problem is all the power, all the wealth is with few, and that affects everybody, right?
With
general,
capitalism.
With capitalism.
Yeah.
But the way it was in most, I can't imagine if we had socialism here, that it wouldn't still in some ways end up the same way as far as that part of it. Now, maybe we'd have health care for everybody. Maybe we'd have a lot of things that are better. But it would still end up with very powerful people with a lot of money, which is what was or still sort of is in Russia, right? I mean,
well,
even under communism, the government had a lot of control. I mean, so here's the thing. You would be giving our government, I feel like, a lot of control, taking it away from private and companies and the wealthy individuals and trusting our government to have that control. That seems scary.
Sure. So you're actually skipping a few steps. You're talking about full state communism, and that is, you know, how I would describe the Soviet Union. And I agree.
And that's not what you're advocating.
No. I mean, I think like a better way to think about socialism in the context in which it's even possible and in the context in which people really root for it right now, or at least the way that I root for it, is that it's more of a value. It's the idea that we shouldn't commodify basic needs, that we can and should set up society in such a way that we don't have to leave healthcare and housing and retirement care to, you know, we don't have to set it up so that you should be able to pay for it and I can raise the price and raise the price so that I can make a profit on your need to survive until you die after you retire and are no longer able to work. That those ideas don't seem that radical to me. And in fact, the vast majority of developed countries have figured out a way to provide those for their people in ways that still allow their citizenry to thrive, in ways that, in fact, are very capitalistic in most cases. That, you know, Sweden is the country that gave us IKEA, that gave us all of these businesses, that, you know, there are entrepreneurs there. They're not suffering. They're not, you know, their businesses aren't crippled. They do have these thriving economic sectors, and they also have pretty comprehensive social democratic states.
Let's get Bob on real quickly,
because
he has been holding on for a bit. Bob, you're on 720 WGN. Good morning.
Hi, good morning. So I'm totally in love with your guest. Both my kids go to DePaul. I retired at 52, and I've been jerked around by Blue Cross Blue Shield of Illinois since the day I retired and have been paying my own premium. I started out at a little over $1,500 a month for a $7,200 deductible with no doctors, with doctors in the plan. Then last year, they decided they're going to jerk me up to $2,500 a month and not have any doctors in my plan in Lake County, Illinois. No North Shore, no Lake Forest Pediatrics, no Lake Forest Hospital, and they're going to charge me $2,500 a month with a $7,300 per person deductible, okay? Mm-hmm. So then I went from a PPO, which that was, to an HMO to be more realistic at $1,500 a month.
Mm-hmm.
Again, all my doctors are not in the plan, even though old Barack said I'd keep them. No, I don't, and I have advocate doctors now. So I went to a doctor in the plan to get my blood pressure medicine re-upped, and it cost me $100 for the visit.
Ugh.
So that was my checkup, and I paid $100 to see the doctor to get a renewal on my blood pressure medicine because my doctors in North Shore are not in the plan.
Yeah. Yeah, there's...
The thing of it is every year now, I mean, who... They're going to increase me $1,000 a month?
It's horrible.
For what?
Yeah.
I don't have anybody in the plan that I've had since I basically have been growing up here.
Exactly, yeah. And that's so disruptive. I think it's so difficult that, you know, if you do have a doctor that knows you and knows your body and knows your conditions and suddenly you have to switch, it's not just expensive and a pain. It's really disruptive for your care.
Well, and this is an issue, and I'm going through the same thing with Blue Cross. We've bought it for years. I can't remember if I told you this off air or on air, but our rates went through the roof. Somebody just texted, well, welcome to Obamacare. You're not necessarily a big fan of Obamacare, are you?
No, I think Obamacare was a vast improvement on what was there before, but it's so insufficient. And Bob, all of the things that you're describing, you're so right. Those are awful problems. Those are all really difficult to deal with. And those are all a function of the fact that, you know, your insurance company is trying to save money, that, you know, you got higher premiums and then they decided to cover fewer providers so that you had fewer choices. And that's how they're trying to keep profits up when healthcare costs keep going up. And single payer is a way to handle a lot of those issues, that it would be a lot easier if you didn't have to, you know, keep looking up every day who's in your network, who's not, that you could go to the providers that you want to and that you knew it would be covered.
Under single payer, would you get to go to any doctor you wanted to? Is that how that works?
Yeah.
And so Obamacare, while good because it insured a lot of people who weren't insured, it clearly screwed up the markets quite a bit because it didn't work out how they wanted, right? I mean, all of our premiums have gone through the roof. So that's bad.
Well, the markets were screwed up to begin with. That wasn't
they weren't
because
this
of...
screwed up.
Well,
the rates have shot up under Obamacare. They were not like this. I had the insurance for a long time before that. And after Obamacare, or after a few years of Obamacare, things, I mean, things have gone awry under that. I'm not saying it was a perfect system before, and I love that a lot more people are insured, and I was willing to embrace that and hope that they figure this out. Now we have an administration in that wants to not improve it, but destroy it and get rid of it. So maybe with more years and tinkering and the right people in place to embrace it and try to figure it out, it would. But it's a failure in some aspects too, right?
Well, I mean, I think that failure or success, I mean, those depend on the values that you have. Certainly under Obamacare, 20 million more people are covered, but 26 million still aren't. And that, to me, I mean, that's the biggest failure of the system, the fact that we still spend so much and don't even cover everybody.
But also for the people that are paying premiums, like mm-hmm. I am, like Bob is, like you are, you just said, unless you cough up a spleen, you're not going in. That's not good for your health care.
Oh, it's absolutely not. No, you're totally right. And part of that is because Obamacare, it's not that it existed that's the problem. It's that it never provided a mechanism to fix some of the biggest problems that existed before it. And that's that there's still no mechanism to control cost. That in a single payer system, this single insurance pool has the leverage to negotiate prices down with providers. That it's able to essentially dictate how much something costs. And under the ACA, that doesn't exist. Mm-hmm. And so basically you have providers dictating their prices and you have a multi-payer system in which each individual insurer isn't able to push back against that and basically just pays whatever's charged. And so there's nothing to push costs down. And so costs are basically just dictated by providers. And then they're further inflated by these insurance companies who need to skim a little bit off the top because they're paying for all of these costs for their clients.
And because they want to make a profit mm-hmm. in the end. Thank you very much for the call, Bob. There's two concerns that Americans will have about this, right? One is that under the socialist system where we're going to take care of these basic things completely, mm-hmm. healthcare, housing, things like that. There's a big thing in America that, well, those people are getting things for free. Those people don't work. Those people, you know, there's people on the dole. Those people rely on the government. That is a huge underlying current of Americans, I think, that they have a big negative towards people get stuff for free. Then they're not going to work. Then they're not trying to be, you know, good, productive citizens. Is that a concern at all with socialism?
Well, I mean, first of all, I think that that's such an American ethos. I think that that's really knocked into our heads because of capitalism. The fact that, you know, you look at someone else and say, like, you're not working hard, you lazy jerk, you shouldn't be doing this. You know, that's very much a competitive mindset. That's a mindset bred by scarcity, that you are trying to shore up all that you can for you and only you, and you want to get yours and no one else, and that sort of resentment is very competitive. It's based on scarcity, and those are things that are bred under capitalism. I'm not saying that, you know, people under capitalism are specifically bad, people under socialism are specifically good, but that's an attitude that's bred by your situation, mm-hmm. largely. I think, I mean, personally, in a system in which we have programs that, you know, we have solidarity with one another, that everyone gets things. I mean, I don't know about you. I don't hear people scowling about all these people on Social Security. You know, I
mean, no, you generally don't, do you?
You generally don't. And I think that that's because it's something that we've come to understand is for all of us. Yeah. And I don't have to be mad at you for being on it, because I'm on it too. And we've all decided that that's part of being in a functional society, that I'm not mad at people for being on Medicare, because I know that that's part of what I want in a society, and that I'm going to be part of that too at some point. And that if you decide that there are a few basic things that everyone deserves, then you decide to take care of all of those things together. And then the rest of society, what you do beyond that, then you can focus on that.
I lost it because I was just looking at what this caller said, but, with Social Security, don't you think there might be a different perception of that because we all pay into it, and we know that if you're getting Social Security, you worked your whole life to get that. That's sort of a built-in pension that you did pay into for your whole life, whereas insurance for everybody. People like let's ask Chuck right here. Chuck wants to be on 720 WGN. Good morning, Chuck.
Hey, how you doing?
Good.
I worked in a steel mill in Northwest Indiana. I'm retired now. And most people can go out and they can seek a job that it pays for good insurance. And good companies will have good insurance so that their employees are taken care of properly. You don't have to go far to get good insurance. You can go to McDonald's. You can go to Whole Foods. You can go to Jewel, Osco, wherever you want to go. They got good insurance. The thing is that everybody's worried about these 28 million people that just got put on Obamacare. How many of them had jobs? And your host just said there's another 22 million that aren't on there. Well, you know, the thing is that how many of those people have never went out and had jobs? You can't throw everybody in the same basket and say, hey, you worked for 40 years in a steel mills, but now we're going to make these guys get free insurance, even though you worked 40 years in a blast furnace. And now their insurance problems are going to impact your insurance problems.
Right.
You know, the Amish people don't have any kind of problems like this. They don't have Social Security. They don't pay into the government thing, and they get along just well.
Chuck, do you want to live like the Amish?
Oh no, I see the Amish all the time though, because I work the farm market.
Okay, but when you say the Amish don't have these problems all the time, well, the Amish live a completely different life than the rest of us lead, so it's a little misleading to say, hey, the Amish aren't having these problems. What's going on with them? Well, they're not doing a lot of things that we're doing, right? I think a question, Chuck, thank you very much for the call. And that's interesting. I'm not going to have you get into it with Chuck because I can see it welling up in you, Natalie. But here's the thing that I will say about what Chuck just said is that I don't think there's 28 million people. That's this perception we have, or maybe a certain segment of us have, is that, oh, those 22 million people without insurance, are they working? Do they have jobs? And we think they're just sitting around watching some 55-inch screen television Obama sent them and eating Doritos all day long and not bothering. And I can't imagine. It drives me crazy when I hear something like that a little bit, because I don't imagine there's a lot of people choosing to never work and just get whatever free thing they can get from the government. Are there people living high on the hog off the government that I just don't realize what the scam is? Because everybody thinks that, you know, these 22 million people without insurance, now they're going to get it for free. They're not bothering to work. That doesn't exist in the real world as much as people think, does it?
No, a lot of the people that aren't insured do have jobs, including at McDonald's, like you mentioned.
Well, that's interesting. You brought up a bunch of places as if insurance is hell. I'll go work 10 hours a week at McDonald's if it's going to get me cheaper insurance than what I'm paying right now. But I'm guessing that
it's not going
to
work.
If there's less than 32 hours a week, you don't have to offer insurance. And I imagine most companies try to do the best they can to hire as many part-time employees as they can, so they don't have to offer insurance.
Absolutely.
Right?
You wouldn't believe how many employers happen to hire workers for about 39 hours a week, and that's all they need.
Is that what the law is right now? If it's not 40 hours a week, you don't have to offer insurance?
There is an employer mandate under Obamacare now. This was one of the things that one of the iterations of Trump Care was trying to cancel, that if you have, I believe it's 50 or more employees, you have to provide health care.
So did that force McDonald's into providing health care for part-time employees, or was that only for full-time employees?
No, that's full-time employees, and it doesn't apply, I don't believe, to franchises, which is how most fast food businesses are structured. That's not at the corporate level.
Okay.
That's if I have a franchise, if I have a McDonald's franchise, I don't have 50 employees there.
Interesting. And anybody who is a part-time employee does not have to be offered insurance. Anybody who's a contractor, things like that,
mm-hmm.
right, still does not
Absolutely.
Have to be offered insurance.
And that's a massive sector of the economy, and that's the fastest growing sector of employees right now. When people talk about how many jobs we've added, a lot of those are part-time, they're temporary, they're freelance, they're contractors, and none of those people are entitled to health care in the same way.
Yeah. So when we have places like McDonald's and things like that, or let's talk about the fight for 15 for a minute. That's not necessarily a socialist issue. I don't know if it is or not, but there's a big, there's a fight for 15
mm-hmm.
to get $15 an hour at jobs like at McDonald's and other places that are part-time employees and on the lower end of the wage scale.
Mm-hmm.
What do you think of movements like that?
Well, I mean, I definitely want vulnerable workers to have as much autonomy as they can. I want them to have as high wages as they can. I think the problem, not the problem, I think that one drawback of Fight for 15 is that it basically relies on a media campaign to shame employers into giving more as opposed to leveraging real power, which is what a union does, right? Mm-hmm. If someone's part of a union, then they have real negotiation leverage. They're able to go at the boss in a real way. That's not what Fight for 15 is doing. It's really difficult to organize workers at that point in the economy, and so I'm really happy that they
So vulnerable, because they can't afford to go on strike, things like that, because
they're atomized, they're replaceable. You know, they're not able to pose the same threat to the employers, but so I'm really happy that Fight for 15 is a way that these workers have been able to exercise power that's been traditionally difficult.
You know, what's interesting is that now we see the fast food places, some of them introducing kiosks to order and things like that. So while I'm happy for the workers to get a better wage, I also wonder if that fight is going to help replace them in some ways too.
Well, and so from a socialist perspective, when you're trying to basically organize a sophisticated economy that provides for people instead of provides profits or provides profits for capitalists, the idea of robots taking our jobs sounds great, right? Like if you're trying to organize an economy that works for all of us, that, you know, the economy goes and builds wealth and then distributes it evenly, please, robots, come take our jobs. I'm begging you. Like that's not a scary thing unless you've specifically tethered employment to livelihood. If you are stuck in a mindset wherein you've decided that if you don't work 40 hours a week, you're going to starve, then robots are very scary. If you've eliminated, you know, socialism basically decides that that's not going to be our default setting. And so automation isn't as much of a threat.
But you do need a job. People don't want to just survive, Natalie. I mean, that's the thing is, this isn't scary because under socialism, we all survive. Yes, we all survive, but we don't all, even in your scenario, it's not like whatever wealth America makes, America distributes among all 350 million people. People still work to have a better life, enjoy more life, travel, do all the things that they want to do. It's not like that would be distributed equally among everyone, right?
Well, I mean, it depends on what type of socialism you're looking for. I mean, certainly most socialists, I think, would want, they don't want people to just thrive or to just survive. They want people to thrive, but there's a way to distribute that too. Obviously, if you are saying, like, what about, you know, automation? What threat will that pose to our system? That basically still implies that, you know, without these jobs, how will we provide for these people? And that's a question that makes a different amount of sense within each system.
Well, I'm not worried about automation, but automation does take away a certain amount of jobs, right? It takes away a lot of factory jobs, things like that. Now, those aren't jobs that we want to say, hey, we want a bunch more factory workers, because what do we want? We want people to be better educated, have more possibilities in life, say for other jobs than just a menial labor job of working in a factory, right? Building a car, things like that. So automation replacing that, we don't want to say, no, they can't do that. Or Trump wants to bring all these factory jobs back from overseas. And I think under Obama, he would say, let's not bring back factory jobs. Let's help people get a higher education. Let's let people get, you know, have more ability to do different things than just a factory job. But if those jobs go away and we have those people, they need jobs too, right? I mean, under socialism, would you say, well, that's okay that the robots came. We just distribute wealth to those people and it's fine?
Well, I mean, partially, yeah. And I will say, you know, I liked Obama so much better than Trump. That's a total given.
Not a big fan of President Obama?
Well, I mean, I think that he had some issues too. And the idea that you are right, that his solution was get a better education and get a better job, which doesn't fundamentally challenge the system. Basically, by saying better, get a better education and get a better job, you're not offering a solution to people who are harmed most by this system. You're just giving them a better strategy to avoid that pain. Someone's still going to be hurt. You're just, you know, pulling some people aside and say, hey, if you don't want to be one of the losers in this system, here's your ticket out. And so that's not a challenge. That's not a fundamental restructuring at all. So
he didn't want to fundamentally restructure, though, did he? I mean, most people don't want to fundamentally restructure. That's kind of what America, at least what we're told, was built on, right? The idea that you can come here with nothing, and build yourself up into whatever you want. That's the ideal of America, right?
Yeah, well, we now know that that is empirically untrue in the overwhelming majority of cases. But here's the thing, like when you say everyone has a job, like, yeah, everyone will have a role to play in any sort of system structured like this. And I'm not even talking about like a post-revolutionary state. I'm saying, okay, even when you think about capitalism, what helps, you know, right now you're here at work at this completely ridiculous hour of the night and you've got several kids, and I assume that you have a spouse at home.
Yes.
With these kids. And
right.
Is anyone paying her to be at home
right now?
Mm-hmm.
No.
Yeah, but she's playing a role right now that's necessary for you to do your job.
Right.
That you're doing your job, you're getting paid, and she's doing unpaid work to support your ability to do that.
Yes.
And so there are all of these roles in our economy that are necessary for our economy to function that aren't paid, that aren't considered work, but they're still, you know, I mean, suddenly if your spouse wasn't at home, then that would be a problem, right? That would be a role that would need to be filled. You can't just leave your kids home on their own. You can't, you know, just suddenly leave elders home. You know, other people take care of older people.
Right.
That you have all of these roles. You know, I have to get to work in a certain way, right? That's unpaid time too. That there are all of these roles in our economy that allow us to do work that aren't paid. And so the idea that there's this, you know, absence of roles, yeah, like robots might be taking the jobs that generate profit, but it's not as if we're going to have idle people in a less commodified system.
All right. That got interesting just now. Can you stay a little while longer?
Sure.
All right. It is 4 o'clock in the morning. Quick break because now we're behind, but she just got radical on me, everybody. Natalie Shure is here, 312-981-7200. Raj, I got to take a quick break because I'm so
sure.
Far behind. News next, 720 WGN. Hello, everybody. I want to make a Russia joke, and it's terrible because I just want to make Russia jokes. Like, and I know that's like, it's like my default. I'm sorry, Natalie. I'm sorry. Through at 298-1-7200. Matt Bubal here. We're here with Natalie Shure. She's been on forever about the Democratic Socialists. And I think it's good that we're learning what you guys are about because you have a very bad reputation. Socialism has a very bad reputation.
We're not that. Do you want to join? Do you want to come tomorrow?
No. I have a baseball game that I have to be at for my sons.
Oh, man.
And I would come to observe and see what you guys are all about. I looked at the photo you put online today. Mm-hmm. From the convention. And this is going to sound really terrible, but it looked just like a sober Lollapalooza crowd.
So I put a few photos up. I'm not like
I
the
saw one...
one
just big of the room and everybody sitting there.
Yeah,
I
it's just
tweet
a
about.
Huge room of hundreds of people.
But it looked like a lot of young,
mm-hmm.
Relatively diverse, but not that diverse. It seemed very white, surprisingly white.
Yeah, I mean, you know, there are a lot of white, but we have a lot of people of color. We have
sure.
Women. We also have like a sizable contingent of older people, retirees, who have been socialists for decades, and they're so excited about this political moment right now, which is really exciting.
Through into 981-7200. Okay, Mark has a comment about birth control and health insurance, I believe. Hey, Mark, you're on 720 WGN. Good morning.
Hello, what a great conversation. This is great radio. You should both be proud. This woman is fascinating to listen to.
Oh, thank you.
Thank you.
All right, what did you want to say?
My general comment is tied to insurance but tied to education about population control, because when people say, oh, those people aren't working, they're not carrying their shift, etc., if we would, as a nation, focus education efforts on population control, there would be less patients to cover. And everyone should be covered, by the way. And then there would be smaller enrollment in schools, so children would be more valuable. I think it's all interrelated. I know it seems off topic or off screen, that comment about general population control education and practicing population control for all economic stratas, not just the poor, but you don't need to have 3 or 4 kids.
So, Mark, are you just promoting more access to birth control, more education about birth control? Or are you saying the government should be a little more stringent on how many children we're allowed to have?
Well, I think it's sort of tied into the idea of socialist awareness. It's not. It is birth control. It's also population control and education about population control and tying that into insurance. And I think that would calm down some of the radical, I don't know, conservatives who are, that's probably the wrong term to use, but to say, well, those people aren't working. No, if everyone, you should be able to have two kids and we'll cover you. Beyond that, if you want to have a third kid in your life, you need to pay for that and pay for their insurance.
Interesting, Mark. Thank you very much for the call. Okay, so I got two kids I got to pay for that because I went ahead and had three. What do you think about that?
Well, for one thing, I mean, there's not a population issue in this country. The fact that we should provide, I absolutely agree that we should provide access to birth control and that every woman should have bodily autonomy to decide how many kids she wants. The argument that any number of kids beyond two is a number of kids we don't want to cover is, I mean, frankly, somewhat eugenic and definitely specifically targeting the poor who often don't have access to the same.
Because the rich could afford to still have more kids and they'd say, that's fine, we'll just cover those kids. I mean, that's how that idea would not.
Yeah, I mean, you know, certainly. kids aren't a commodity in the same way as, you know, everyone gets these two things. And if you want to buy more, then fine. Yeah. I mean, that's a really dangerous way to think about human beings. And, you know, in terms of socialism, I think give people the tools to decide to fulfill their destinies and have families the way that they want to.
The way that they choose.
And I don't. Yeah, that's not going to be a social threat.
Okay. 630 writes, referring back to when you were talking about Colleen at home, by that way of thinking, shouldn't Matt's wife be taking care of 20 working mothers' children, stay-at-home mom as a job, to earn her socialist salary? And I don't have or want kids, so I should get a refund. Maybe I get a free Mountain Dew. I don't know why 630 wants a Mountain Dew, but
I'm
I don't think that's exactly
what you're
saying.
I'm confused as to why Colleen has 20 kids under her.
Well, because you were saying that with socialism, we're distributing the wealth, and Colleen is not working because she's at home taking care of the kids. So under socialism, then shouldn't she be helping out with other people too?
Well, I mean, my point was that, you know, in like under socialist values, I'm not talking about a fully realized socialist society, but if you really start to think analytically about the system we live in now, there are a lot of unpaid roles that still do things that we need for our society to function, and that Colleen's doing one of those things. I agree with 630. I don't have children currently. I don't know if I
you
ever want
them. You want a refund
them.
Too? Do I have to give you money to it?
No, I don't demand a refund. That just means that I'm able to contribute in different ways and that I'm able to provide different sorts of value and that I take different things from society, that I, you know, contribute according to my need and or contribute toward it according to my ability and take according to my need, and that that's what we trust each other to do.
How what do the socialists think of our current tax structure in America?
Well, I mean, current tax structure, it's a little difficult to say. I mean, generally, I think that socialists would recognize that in a capitalist context, taxation is the way that you would raise revenue to create social democratic programs. I think that, I mean, from a personal point of view, our tax structure is very regressive in a lot of ways, that I think that wealthy people should pay more taxes than they do, that a lot of the exemptions that we have right now favor the rich in ways that are really shocking and inappropriate, and that those things should be reconsidered. But okay. I don't trust the GOP to do it.
Do you trust Democrats to do it?
Not. I mean, I trust them more.
That's the thing that seems tough, because socialism is so, I know this is not right, but radical and revolutionary in a way, at least here in America, to our mindset, the way we've been raised, right? It's really revolutionary and it's radical. And like, well, you even admitted, we talked about, you know, that the way the Soviet Union was is not like the end all be all. This
Absolutely
is how it
not.
Should be. But the concern would be you're saying that we're going to give more government control. And I think everybody on both sides says, wait a minute, let's not give government more control because nobody trusts anybody who's running the government, it seems, ever. Whether it was President Obama or Clinton or anybody, nobody wants to pour a lot more into the idea of government will take care of this.
Yeah, no, especially not if you're talking about a strictly centralized government structure. I mean, definitely a really cherished feature alike or common to most socialists, I think, is the idea of democratic localized control. And so, you know, they would say all power to the Soviets, the local councils.
That'd be like more power to our states here, then, is what you're saying?
Well, not necessarily.
That doesn't seem so great either.
Not necessarily in the structure that we have them, but that you would have structures in place that empower local people with local knowledge that would have some check on completely centralized state power. And you are right that there are a lot of reasons to doubt that in the specific structure we have. And
don't we have that now in some ways? Counties have control, states have control. Federal government has control. Aren't there a lot of checks right now on things?
Well, I mean, they have control to make, you know, certain laws within a broader context, but they're not necessarily there to, you know, create more freedom and autonomy and, you know, distribute wealth in a significant way for people who are nearby.
Every time you say distribute wealth, I think there's people with the hairs that just go up on the back of their neck. There's a really maligned phrase, distribute wealth and redistribute wealth. And President Obama took a massive beating over the idea of redistribution of wealth. Let's take a quick break. I want you to comment on that and some great texts that have come in as well. 312-981-7200. Matt Bubala with Natalie Shore from the Democratic Socialist Convention here in town this weekend on 720 WGN. Matt Bubala with you, 720 WGN. We're live from the Allstate Showcase Studio here on Michigan Avenue in the historic Tribune Tower with the story producer. No, I keep forgetting
exactly.
The title. Story producer for Adam Ruins Everything on True TV. When is it on True TV?
It's on Tuesday nights.
Tuesday nights on True TV. Are we in season two?
Yes.
Season two of Adam Ruins Everything, which is making Natalie a lot of money, which is distributing very equally across America. No, she's not, but she would. She would.
I'm paying my socialist dues.
How much are these socialist dues?
Well, we voted today to, I think, potentially raise them to $120 a year is the standard. And then if you make more, you can pay more.
Because that's how it would work out, right? If you make less, you should have to pay less. If you make more, you're going to pay more.
Absolutely. Right? And I think that this is an organization that's really going to honor that.
Okay. All right. So we've got some very interesting texts that have come in. 312 writes, I really appreciate what your guest has to say. America is exhausted with all the whining from millionaires. They need to put the victim card away and act like Americans.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. 630 writes, thanks for reading that, Matt. I don't know what I read, but bottom line, two-party system isn't working anymore. I'm wearing a Ron Paul 2008 shirt right now.
You know, I would change off the shirt, but I agree with the first part for sure.
People are sick of both parties. We need more choices.
Absolutely.
773 says, guest says that a person who worked hard to become rich should be required to share their earned money with someone who didn't work or sacrifice as much.
Yeah, I mean, I would question what they mean by earned exactly. That person was able to position themselves in a way that was advantageous in a system that's inherently unfair. I don't know why that stands to be rewarded more than other people who work equally hard. That's the other thing. This idea that people who are poor don't work hard couldn't be further from the truth.
It couldn't be further from the truth, of course. People work hard probably no matter what their job is. Some people don't. Some people work harder. Of course, that's a natural part of human life, right? Some people work harder than others. Fine. And some people end up making their millions, not because they worked harder than anybody else, but maybe they were smarter or got into the right business or did whatever.
Or they had money from their parents. There are so many ways to position yourself to make a ton of money in a capitalist system. And I don't think that too many of them have to do with human merit or you being worth more than someone else.
It doesn't mean anybody's worth more than anybody else, but I do have a trouble with that. So I brought up Zuckerberg early, and it's not somebody I hold to a high ideal at all, but he started this company.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of the dot-com companies say start from a grassroots sort of place. They have a great idea. It takes off. People invest, and it becomes a big thing. Why should he have to redistribute? I mean, because he didn't manually work harder than anybody else for that? I mean, why should he redistribute that wealth?
Well, I mean, you know, there are a few questions between, you know, him giving all of his wealth away and him keeping billion. I mean, can you think of any human reason that we should have someone on this earth? We should have multiple people on this earth who have $40 billion fortunes.
Because I don't think there's a reason why they shouldn't. Because if they worked and earned that because of whatever reason, then they did that.
Well, he worked, and then we decided that he earned it because that's the way that all of our financial and business systems are structured.
Because
that they were able to funnel it back to him.
Because we all bought into this idea of this stupid fit. We're all on Facebook. We're all contributing to his profits. So we all saw value in that, and that made him that money. And, you know, listen, Warren Buffett has a ton of money. He's doing a lot of good with it. Bill Gates has a lot of money. He's doing a ton of good with it. I like to think that the people that make a lot of money, I trust them as much as I trust our government to spend. Look at how much you mentioned militarism off the air. Think about how much our government spends on military. Think about all the scandals over the years with how our government spends money and all the ridiculous things our government spends money on. Mm-hmm. If Bill Gates gave his $40 billion to our government, I don't trust it would be spent better than Bill Gates will and the work he's doing across the world for healthcare, things like that.
Well, so here's the thing. I do agree with you that the government does not spend its money in a way that I think is universally admirable. I think that a lot of the great things that we do need in society are public goods as opposed to private ones. Mm-hmm. The government misspends a lot of money, spends a lot of money deplorably, but a lot of the things that people truly need, things like Social Security, things like Medicaid, Medicare, those things are public and those things could never be provided by the private sector. I do think that there are some really remarkable charities. I've actually done a lot of reporting. I was a journalist previously before working for Adam, and I reported a lot on the Gates Foundation, specifically their work in global health. And I think that they do some really admirable work, and I think pretty much everyone would agree. That said, deciding that we want to have all of these billionaires and that we don't want to question that paradigm because of the philanthropy that they do, that's basically saying that you want to de-democratize public need, that you want to say that there are things that people need, things like, you know, global health services that you know that we need, but you want to basically just put it in the hands, hoping that there's a nice enough billionaire that comes along.
No, I'm not saying that. I'm saying government should handle those things, but mm-hmm. that doesn't mean it should be stripped away from other people who have amassed their fortune in whatever ways that they have.
Well, so I think that there are two. I think that there are two arguments. First of all, these things aren't disconnected. The fact that there are billionaires isn't just some fluke that we get to exist alongside of. The fact that there are billionaires is indicative of this system that basically exists to extract resources from every other sector of our economy, from other people, toward the top. It's not some, you know, interesting fluke that exists outside of the rest of our politics. It's absolutely part of it. And I do agree that the government doesn't currently make good spending decisions, but that's the entire purpose of politics. That's why the Democratic Socialists of America have gathered in Chicago this weekend, because we want to start a movement to demand something different, that we want better decisions to be made, that we want democracy and government spending to be decommodified, to provide services for people, to provide programs that people find solidarity in, that people can, you know, thrive, that people can get health care, that they can get child care, that they can get elder care, that they can get education, and not have to bend over backwards suffering to provide these things and just scrape by providing them for just their own families, that we can bond together. And that those are, it's a colossal political project, but that's how you do it. It's through politics. That the spending that exists right now sucks, and that we're trying to change it. That's the whole point.
When you talk about education, and you talk about, so if we look at, you know, healthcare, and we talk about the healthcare wouldn't change, it wouldn't get worse because we did this. When we look at the American education system and colleges, whose expenses have gone spiraling out of control, mm-hmm. but a lot of people from other countries send their kids to the U.S. for college education. Mm-hmm. And so there would be an argument that, listen, if you got rid of the way that colleges run, the profits that they're trying to make and endow themselves, et cetera, there would be less that would lessen the quality of the education because the professors and things would go elsewhere. That's a big argument with socialism. And do you think that wouldn't hold true for colleges, just like you don't think it would for healthcare?
No, I mean, I would love for those people to show me why exactly massive tuitions are the reason that we have a good public, or I'm sorry, a good secondary education system or higher education system.
Because the idea would be that the best professors are going to go where they're going to make the most money. And so if they are not going to be paid that way because, and then, so then some other country is going to say, hey, we're going to take advantage of that and there'll be a brain drain. They'll go where the money is, right? Why wouldn't they?
I mean, there are some good, very highly paid professors, but I would argue that the function of that in most cases isn't to improve the quality of the education. It's to improve the prestige of the institution. And actually, in a lot of cases, if you have these, you know, really prominent celebrity professors, and maybe I'm playing the, you know, conservatives out there, if you guys were mad at me, I think that there's, you know, something like if you guys want to rail against the colleges, that's fine too. I think sometimes these very highly paid professors, while being very impressive, they're not necessarily providing a higher quality education to their students. A lot of the time, you know, graduate students who are getting paid practically nothing are doing a lot of the work for them. So I don't think that there's much to that argument.
I promise you I'd let you go at 4:30, but now I'm late for the news and I still have more text. You hang out a little bit more. Okay. 4:31 in the morning. Let's check the headlines. Here's Mr. Roger Badish. All right, Matt Bubala with you, 720 WGN. Natalie and I are going at it now off the air because I do think that's very interesting that I'm talking off the air about just, I asked Natalie, so when do we start redistributing this wealth? At what point, and because I do think that it takes away from incentive, things like that. And I do think that a lot of the issue in America with, because I was telling Natalie that I think there are millions and millions of us Americans who would describe ourselves as poor, who are by no means statistically poor at all. We live above the poverty line. We actually have plenty of money. However, we are ridiculously in credit card debt, or we're overextended on our house. We have a home equity, all these things that make us feel poor, but are not really poor. And I do think there is a personal responsibility portion of that because I chose to go on vacation last year instead of paying off my credit card debt, or I bought more gifts for Christmas than I really could truly afford. And now we're, you know, dealing with that. You don't think that there is, and you just said to me off the air, well, now you're arguing that you just need to do capitalism better and you would argue against that. But I do think there's an argument for that. I mean, we are, as Americans, not smart enough about how we should be about things.
Yeah. I mean, you know, I think that there's always there's always something to be said for, like, we all make those kind of mistakes. I do. I'm sure you do. I think there aren't too many people who are immune to that, not just in America, but in the world. That said, I think that, first of all, the things that you're describing, people who think of themselves as poor because they have ABC, a lot of the things that you're describing are pretty legitimate material struggles. They're not just cosmetic, blasé, like, oh, $20,000 in credit card debt. Oh, yeah, silly whiner. I mean, those are, you know, pretty significant things.
They are.
People rack up credit card debt for a number of reasons, you know, medical bills.
Absolutely. I'm not dismissing that there are plenty of people who did that out of need, not out of...
Yeah, so like, I guess
I think
I'm
there's many more of us that are doing it because we're just making decisions we maybe shouldn't make, or figure, oh, we'll make more money, or we'll pay it off, or we'll live with that.
Sure. I mean, yeah, like sometimes people make bad decisions, but I guess I'm questioning the premise that people struggle because they just made all of these crappy decisions and that's it. I think that that's more or less, I mean, I don't think that that really measures up to reality, that is the majority of the reason why people struggle materially in America right now. And I think that looking at situation as if it's like that, I think that assuming that the majority of people's financial struggles, financial hardships are because they made the wrong decision, they went out to eat too much, they, you know, stayed in a more expensive hotel than they should, basically budgeting problems, I think that it basically lets all of these difficult, it lets the system off the hook. It lets all of the larger level problems off the hook completely and says basically that the real problem is that you're not good enough at this system. It's not the system that's the problem. It's not these, you know, predatory lenders. It's not the commodification of every last thing that we need in our lives. It's not stagnant wages. It's actually the fact that you're really bad at budgeting, Matt. And if you were better at this, then everything else would be better. And these guys aren't to blame. Nothing else is wrong.
See, but if you make your argument, you're pushing our problems off on other people. Oh, it's not your fault. It's those predatory lenders. It's the way the government's set up. You're set up to fail. That's just as bad of an argument, because people making, let's say, round numbers here, between $60,000 and $125,000 in America, that's enough to live on, right? That should be enough to have an existence.
I mean, that's above the average income, too.
It is, but way above the average income. What's the average income? 40, 50 right now, the median?
I mean, for one individual, or for a family, I think it's less than 60,000.
Okay. So, but that group, so let's say the group above, from 60 to 125,000, that group feels poor in America. And they're by no means poor, right? But so,
well, they live in cities in which they have a lot of costs. I mean, that's the thing. Like,
don't
if you
start defending them, you've got these people. Stay with me now.
No, but find a family that's struggling financially, chances are they're not just dummies who don't know how to handle their personal finances.
Yes, we are. I guarantee you, you're wrong about that.
I'm not saying that they've never made a mistake, but I am saying that you know for a fact, all of the things that I was just talking about, all of those macro issues, those things all exist, right?
Yes.
Those things really do exist and pinch people. So the fact that you do have millions of people struggling with these issues probably means that we don't have millions of individual idiots. We have a system that pushes people toward these decisions, that really squeezes them. And yeah, some people are better or worse in that situation.
Well, especially the people making less than those amounts. They are affected by predatory lenders, by things like that, because they're trying to make decisions to survive day to day, to pay into this healthcare system, to pay the same amount of tax on milk as somebody making $100,000 a year, and all of those things. So yes, I completely agree that people on the lower end of the scale, but the people who are listening to this show and the people who you have on the radio right now listening, I think are in the other group, the 60 to 125,000 and more. And those people call and complain and say, I remember when I was producing here years ago, I had somebody call up who was making $150,000 a year and talking about how bad they were struggling. And I was laughing at the time because I was 20 years old, making $20,000. I'm like, please, you're not struggling. And you're like, no, the struggle is real. Da, da, da. People making a lot of money feel very poor. And it's, in my mind, because of our bad decisions. I think that is a way bigger issue than you think it is here in America. I think we make poor decisions incredibly. And yes, we're bad at capitalism and need to be better at it. But like you said, it's not going to completely go away. Even if you guys really get this movement going, it's going to maybe get single payer or get us to support better some of the programs that we currently have. It's not going to completely change the structure, right?
Well, I mean, I don't think that there's any realistic chance of that happening anytime soon. But
is that the hope,
even single payer, if you think about, I mean, even these, you know, people at the incomes that you're describing can be completely financially decimated by medical bills very easily.
Yes. Yes.
And so, you know, something like single payer, the difference that would make in people's lives materially with their finances and their health and their peace of mind and the way that they think about their lives and what they deserve, I think it would be completely transformative.
Somebody texted that socialism keeps people poor.
Mm-hmm. I mean, socialism basically provides the things that we need.
My guess is they're arguing that it takes away incentive to get wealthier. Do you think that it does take away incentive?
Well, it takes away incentive to work in the ways that we do, in the specific ways in which we work. But I would ask why that's a social value. You know, okay, so under socialism, I think that people make different decisions about work. You know,
so maybe we have a better work-life balance then, if there were true
socialism?
Yeah,
they'll have a better work-life balance. I think that there will be fewer people making, you know, think of how many people go into finance now. There'll be fewer people doing that. But I also think that there are a lot of problems. Like, I don't think that the way that our economy is structured and the way that our economy is incentivized is inherently good. I don't think that any serious person would make that argument.
How How old are you, Natalie? Can I ask that?
Yes, I am 30.
You are 30. God, mm-hmm. I thought you were like 24. Okay. You're 30. So 20 years from now, mm-hmm. I'm sure I won't have the show anymore, but 20 years from now, we're going to get back together and talk again. Because okay. It'd be very interesting to see if you change, you know, because we all change. What the famous saying is that if you're young and not a Democrat, you have no soul. If you're old and not a Republican, you have no money. Something like that, right?
Yeah, no, I mean, that's what people say. No, I mean, I'm 30. I've, knock on wood, I'm doing fairly well professionally. Like, these are actual entrenched political beliefs. Yeah. I'm not just, you know, I mean, oh, if you disagree with me, that's
no.
fine.
You still might change. I do believe, though, that we change sure. from decade to decade massively.
Absolutely.
It'll be very interesting. It'll be very interesting.
I do think, you know, and I do think that conventional wisdom suggests that because at least in the 20th century, for most of it in the American context, a lot of people have been upwardly mobile. And so in their 20s, they're very radical. They're far to the left. And then they amass more resources. They make more money and then want to protect them.
And they think, lower taxes. That sounds good. Where
sure.
was that all my life?
But so you can go talk to a lot of our politicians over the past several decades. Maybe we'll talk about this some other episode.
Yeah.
But I don't think my generation is going to amass resources and get wealthier in the ways that others did. And
well,
I don't know if we're going to get more conservative. I think that we're very leftist. I think that we're very radical. And no one's paying us off not to be. So
yeah, but remember
all
those people in the 60s? They were very leftist and radical too, right?
And they made money and we're not making any money. Look at the economies between then and now, and they're totally different.
They weren't making any money then either, were they? When they were leftist and radical? No.
People who are born in about, you're describing baby boomers right now. People who are born in the
hippies and people like that in the radical 60s.
Yeah,
when they were
teenagers
radical,
in the 60s,
they
they're baby boomers. They're now the most conservative
I know,
jerks
is, this
in
is
the
what
country,
you're facing,
ruining everything. You,
well,
listener, you
oh
personally.
Oh, my
no.
God. Wow.
No, but, you know, I mean, that's definitely a political process that you can observe, that as people make more money, they do swerve to the right.
So we're going to see how you do,
because
well, you're going to have a very successful career ahead of you.
Let's we'll restructure see. The economy and get us some money and then talk about how we all feel.
You're going to make it from just being successful. Okay, so last thing. Mm-hmm. So the convention this weekend.
Yes.
And then what's on the agenda for the socialists? Are you guys promoting candidates? So we have elections coming up, national elections, another year. And a chance to, mm-hmm. you know, change Congress around. Are there DSA candidates who will be out in public? And because DSA or socialism really flies under the radar right now.
Yeah. So it's still a small. We do have some people at the local level. We mm-hmm. have, you know, there's an alderman in Chicago, Alderman Rosa, I believe, who is a Democratic socialist. And he's excellent. He actually addressed our convention 2 days ago. For the most part, though, I think that we're too small an organization to run too many candidates in the national level. But what we can do is work with candidates to, you know, try to push them to the left. We can develop movements that mm-hmm. try to build momentum around things. We really are focusing on single-payer healthcare, as well as a few other issues. But that's something that, as far as I know, everyone in the organization feels really passionately about. And we have voted to make a national priority. And so, you know, I don't think that we're going to see too many people specifically running as Democratic Socialists of America, but I
right.
would like to create a political movement in which single-payer health care and support for it is a litmus test for any Democrat.
Mm.
You know, that I don't want to see any more Democrats say, like, oh, sure, it's a great idea, but it's unrealistic. I want to support Obamacare, blah, blah. Like, support Obamacare over Trump care, because anything that they're going to do is going to make it infinitely worse. But I want to see single-payer being just an absolute given for anybody running on a Democratic ticket, and Republicans support it too, according to poll numbers. I want to see people just demanding that at the top of their lungs.
Interesting. Okay. We'll talk again. You get to back to Chicago once in a while?
Yeah, absolutely. My family lives here, so
well,
I'm here a lot.
The next time you're willing to stay up all night long chatting with us, we'd love to have you back.
Great.
It's been awesome. 312-981-7200 is the number. This is Matt Bubala with you. Natalie Shirley, you can follow her at, what's the Twitter handle? At Natalie Shirley?
At Natalie Shirley, Natalie, N-A-T-A-L-I-E, Shirley, S-U-R-E-L-Y.
At Natalie Shirley. She's very funny on Twitter. She's very to the left, so if you're jumping on board, be ready for her. And you can find out more about the Democratic Socialists of America at DSA.org.
Mm-hmm.
DSA.org. Have a great rest of your convention. Stay out of trouble. Don't, you know, Don't get too revolutionary.
I won't. Don't worry.
You
I'm
guys
very nice.
Marching on the streets or anything like that this weekend, right?
Marching on the streets isn't that crazy, but no, we're mostly going to be inside.
Pretty lame. You guys need to do something bigger than that or something, I suppose.
Yeah, we're mostly, you know, debating and voting this weekend. It's very lame.
It doesn't sound as revolutionary as it should.
Oh, we got to step it up.
Thank you so much for coming
in. Thank
you. All right, news coming up in a little bit. 720 WGN. Viva la revolution! I don't know. What am I supposed to say there, Raj? Something like that.
Let's all go to the bar.
Matt Bubala with you, 720 WGN. Well, that was a very interesting couple of hours.
Yeah.
Thank you very much.
You were in your prime, young man.
Well, that was just very I don't know anything about socialism other than, as Natalie said, what we've heard over the years and what she believes is not the maybe proper representation of it.
Mm-hmm.
And I want to commend the listeners who are very good, because I know that for most of you, you're like, what the hell is this?
Yeah.
But she lost them when she called conservatives jerks at the end or whatever. She's, I said, Natalie, you had them. The people were listening, and now you just, you know, now everybody goes back into their hives. And
but it was very interesting, different insight.
It was different insight. And people are mad that she called conservatives jerks. And she was more teasing, although I'm sure she does feel that way. She was more just kind of nudging people.
And what political party doesn't call other political parties names?
Let's face it, if you want socialism, you should be better than that.
Well,
I mean, if Michelle said they go low, we go high, socialists say we're going even higher.
Okay.
So I took her to task for that. Good. But 773 writes, with capitalism, you can strive for what you want to attain. There's nothing stopping your dreams, what you work hard for. And I think Natalie would try to argue that's not different necessarily under socialism. But there's two different things here. Socialism that she believes we can achieve in America, and that true socialistic ideal. Socialism she believes in America is more, they want a safety net. They want to protect the poor. They want to have health care for all. They want to have better access to child care for people. And I don't think those are bad things to work on. I do think that was more of the idea of Obamacare. Obamacare has not worked out in the way that anybody, I think, wanted. I am a big supporter of Obamacare because I like the idea of everybody having health care, but God knows it has decimated my premiums and made the health care system even more screwed up maybe than it was. But I thought she was very good. 773 says, we're struggling now because America is leaning toward socialism. Higher taxes are strangling people. We're giving our government money to waste. That's the thing I was telling her. I don't understand how socialists are going to say, yeah, let's give more money to the government. In her ideal, we revamp the government. But I really feel, you look at any society, anywhere, absolute power corrupts.
Mm-hmm.
And governments are always somewhat corrupted. There's always going to be issues. And I just worry about the idea of government will take care of more. I like the idea I'm not against single payer. I'd like to hear more about it and how that would actually work and the concerns that people have about it. I think we should talk more about that in the coming weeks, Jess. We should look into who a good guest would be to talk about something like that. I certainly want Social Security saved. I think Medicare, Medicaid, all those things should be saved and strengthened.
Mm-hmm.
After that, I get a little leery of it. And I certainly don't like that term redistribution of wealth.
Well,
not that I have anything to redistribute, but I hope to someday. And quite honestly, that's why most Americans don't like it. And I would argue with her that whether poor or rich, we all live like we're rich because we think we're going to be rich someday. We all look at the Kardashians or people on TV or whatever,
mm-hmm.
and we all aspire to these things. And a lot of us live above our means, I think, because of it.
But that's a big problem in my mind. Why can't we live within our means? Why can't we just accept that we are who we are?
Because that is no fun, Raj.
But
who wants to live within their means?
But it's just like in sports, and you get I've had to deal with these kids in high school. Every single one of them is going to be the next superstar in football or in baseball or in soccer,
right,
or in hockey or in basketball. And you know what? And we did the percentages based on how many players play in the professional sports, how many players are in high school, how many players are in college. And we did the math in class. I did it with my high school athletes, and they had an awakening. So let's live within our means. Let's learn how to do something we enjoy doing that we can get paid for, and let's do that. And these other things, if we are in that 1% of ability, not finances, I'm not talking about that, about the 1% of ability, because, you know, I'd like to throw a 100-mile-an-hour fastball. I'd like to run a 15-second 40-yard dash or whatever a good time is. I'd like to be able to do all those things. But you know what? I never have been, and I'm not going to. So now what do I find that will fill that void of what I desire, what I would like to succeed at? And I think I have found it. And I think everybody needs to take a step back and say, this is what I want in my life. These are the important things to me, even now in high school, in college. Here's what in 30, 40, 50 years is going to be important to me, because fame is fleeting. No. Money is fleeting.
You can't decide in high school, Raj, what's going to be important to you in 30, 40
years. No, I understand.
You change too much.
Things do change, but can set out.
Too.
Yeah, of course we change over our lives. Of course we do. Things happen to us. Good and bad. I understand that.
But also just our ideologies change over the years. We grow. We're not the person in high school or in college or in our 20s that we are in our 30s and 40s. I firmly believe.
Try to be a little more realistic in high school and college as to what our futures might be. Not everyone can be a Kardashian.
That's true. It's unfortunate, but it's true.
Yeah.
847 writes, she had me, then she lost me.
Ooh.
I'm a baby boomer. Yes, Matt, you're correct. We absolutely were radicals back then, and we've all turned into conservative jerks, as your guest accused. I'll look forward to that discussion decades down the road if I'm lucky enough to be here. Great show as always. Thank you very much, 847. And then 630, text winner of the day. I don't have a prize list. However, if I did, 630 would get a prize. Great job with that interview. I was pissed, then intrigued, then happy. It was like listening to a Taylor Swift album.